together as humanity, that then allows the existentialist this opportunity to step out and explore who they are within individuality. So within this course, we'll be looking at a lot of thinkers with a lot of powerful insights into the human condition, how we look, how we study existence. And then when we get to Thornton Wilder in particular, we'll be talking about a play that he wrote to demonstrate the importance of stepping out and discovering who you are as an individual within a framework. So existentialism for me was that opportunity to say, who am I? What does it mean to be human? Particularly because I also have a physical disability. How do I make sense of that experience and how I relate to others? Right? The existentialist is concerned with who they are. They are not only concerned with who they are currently, they are concerned with making a life, as Aaron stated, that is meaningful, that has impact, that changes, that allows them to move forward, right? Does not keep them, as Jean-Paul Sartre would say, forlorn, alone, and in despair. Those are the three characteristics of the human person, that they are thrust into a world and they are forlorn, they are alone, and they are in despair. So existentialism seeks to call the human being to awareness, call the human being to action, to make a life that is meaningful, impactful, and I think Heidegger would say this more in his later works than Being in Time, but to make a life that is beautiful. So what are your thoughts on that, gentlemen?
I think what's interesting about this approach, so the reason I think that it's been made to seem cheesy or kitschy, or that it's been used so much in popular culture, is because it is such a pervasive question for most people. I think many, many people, if not most people, enter a point in their life when they wonder, what is going on? What is this all about? Why am I here? You know, what am I doing in this world? What is the world and who am I in it? Maybe not to the extent that we take it. I would say we're maybe a little bit unique in our nerdiness in that respect. But no, I mean, seriously, I think a lot of people take that journey in their own way. And that's why it's such a popular thing to talk about, because a lot of people can relate to it. And I think that's our job as philosophers, or people who dive into this particular subject more deeply, is to see how far this thought train can take us, and then communicate that, whatever findings we make, back to other people who maybe don't want to or don't have the capacity to go on that journey for themselves. I'm excited to get to Kierkegaard for the reason that I think there's a couple of passages of Fear and Trembling, and there's a couple of moments there that I think really exemplify what we're talking about in terms of taking that dive within.
I just wanted to kind of respond to that, the commonality of people coming to this situation where they encounter a fundamental question, or a sort of, this is a different term, I don't think it's quite appropriate, but a sort of dark night of the soul where they really don't know what's going on and they're grappling with fundamental questions. I think one of the reasons that is so common now also is because we find ourselves in a particular condition that seems conducive of that question being raised. And that is to allude to the tie between existentialism and modernity. I'm not a historian, so I can't exactly say what that means, and maybe someone else can speak to that, but that seems to be one of the traits of existentialism, is it could have only happened when it did. It was a particular response to a historical condition.
Authors refer to what's called the existential moment, which is essentially the period in time following the Second World War and the atrocities that occurred therein. And I think many people at that point in history began to write and to question on what exactly we were doing to each other and to ourselves in that particular moment. And you know, what there are some ethical boundaries that seem to have been crossed that seemed pretty immovable up until that point. And it also has to do with a gradual, what we call disenchantment of the world, in the sense that if you think back to the Greeks, I think I've talked about this on previous episodes, but you think back to the Greeks and the way they saw nature, everything imbued with the gods or with some kind of otherworldly extra human presence, that really does fade over the course of history to a point where God dies in the end, as Nietzsche put it, and as Kierkegaard also put it, heavily criticizing modern Christianity for the way it tackles things. Again, that's sort of off topic, but yeah, I just wanted to offer some historical clarity to that from what I know.
So there's been a lot of good topics and subjects brought up here. I think what the existential moment shows us, as we begin to dive into existentialist thinkers, is the desire the desire and disillusionment of belonging to a bigger group of society. Because especially post-Second World War, we saw this major group of people commit nothing but atrocities, all in the name of political and ideological ideas that were just evil in nature and destructive. So the existentialist comes to a place where you become disillusioned that society itself has the best interest in mind. And so the existentialism comes out of a moment to discover who is humanity, but who am I within humanity? And it is Kierkegaard who comes to mind in terms of finding an outlet for community. Because Kierkegaard, in his leap of faith aspect of writing, posits that there are three states of life. And so there's the life of the ascetic that is based out of a fear of punishment. So you act as to avoid punishment. So your life is, this is how it was explained to me, as in terms of ethics, one of my professors explained it this way, that you act out of fear, out of necessity, rather than personal interest. Personal interest to benefit yourself, you strive to strictly survive. You have no community. You are alone. And then you grow and you journey, you come to the life of the ethical. So you find community in the pursuit of ethics, right? There's lots of people that are attempting to, excuse me for one moment, to pursue ethics. But you're still fundamentally alone, because it's based upon your experiences, your interpretations of how ethics works. This is where Kierkegaard introduces the leap of faith, or the step of faith, that you take that step of faith and you enter the life of the religious person, and you empty yourself of all that you are for an infusion of divine grace, and you find community through relationship with the divine. That's Kierkegaard's case. Now, for the more cold and almost jaded existentialist like Sartre, he would say, "That's a bunch of garbage, and here's why." He would say, "That doesn't matter, because all there is you fundamentally. You can't be absorbed into other people. That's not what it is to live authentically." The existentialist was also primarily concerned with questions of not only existence, but at its core, authenticity. What does it mean to be authentic? What does it mean to be true? What does it mean to act authentically? And this is one of the interesting questions that we'll come back to time and time again in terms of the literature, right? Nietzsche's concept of the true philosopher that can be seen in his work Beyond Good and Evil, right? The true philosopher has immense power, has immense skills, but authenticity is required because Nietzsche says, and I'm paraphrasing, that the true philosopher, the person who embodies the true philosopher that understands what philosophy truly is, can either come too early or they can come too late. And so the practice of authenticity is being willing and ready to act authentically in accordance to who you are. So within this mini-series, we'll be dealing with existentialism itself, we'll be dealing with authenticity, we'll be touching on being, we'll be touching on how we respond in existentialism, and I'm sure there'll be many other side quests. As one of my colleagues pointed out in a class the other day, I said something and they were like, "Side quest unlocked." So I'm sure there'll be a couple side quests unlocked, but I think I would raise this question as a overarching question for this miniseries. The question is, what does authenticity actually mean? Does authenticity mean we just go with the flow and we just do whatever we want to do? Or is there some responsibility in authenticity? Is there somewhat of a moral aspect to authenticity? Because I would argue there is, but we will get there eventually. So we will start with Kierkegaard. And then we'll go to Nietzsche, then we'll go to Heidegger, then we'll go to our town, and we'll probably have a couple miniature stops along the way, because existentialism is wide and varied, but as a self-professed Heideggerian, I will endeavor to limit my Heideggerian biases so that we can look at all these texts and see what they have to offer us. So I don't know about you guys, but I'm excited to stop being forlorn, alone, and in despair, and find a community of individuals that are ready to pursue authenticity, pursue their existence, and maybe we'll finally get rid of that pesky existential dread we all have.
If you could do that for me, that would be great.
Yeah, right? It would be great if I could finally get rid of that myself.
Yeah, yeah, be careful what you propose for us, Tegan.
I know. So, But I think just because this is the overview episode, I think I will just outline some of the key aspects off the top of my head of the authors that we will be covering, so that our astute listeners can be ready and willing to engage. So, Soren Kierkegaard, good dude. He's considered the grandfather of existentialism. I look to him because he shows us three stages of life that we all go through at one point or another. Even if it isn't in his more traditional European Christian concept, right? As we grow up, we don't necessarily, we're not always acting as full rational moral agents. Sometimes we just don't do things because we don't want our parents to be mad at us, so we don't do those things. And then as we grow to be a little bit wiser, a little bit older, a little more life experience, we start to establish boundaries, and we start to establish right kind of limits and frameworks for how we navigate personal relationships, which would be in Soren Kierkegaard's case would be the life of the ethical. And then from there, we often come to a place where we come to a fork in the road, and we have to embrace our inner Robert Frost, right? And two roads diverged in the wood, and I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference, right? We're at the fork in the road, so we kind of have to empty ourselves of any prior expectation and allow possibility itself to present itself to us. And then we're given the free choice, because for all existentialists, we are free moral agents. And to flee our freedom, as Sartre says, it's just a bad idea. You can't not be free. And with that freedom in mind, I want to take a moment to remind our listeners, you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your main host for today, Tegan Marshall, and we are having an overview episode to introduce our theory and mini-series on existentialism. And right off the jump, I'm going to hand it to our colleague, Mihai Kovasser.
Thanks. I just wanted to jump in here briefly on the tail end of sort of your overview of Kierkegaard to add a couple of points, if I may, that I think would be interesting to explore. Because you mentioned, you've talked a lot so far about this idea of finding community in some sense, no longer being alone, forlorn, as you said. And it's interesting because on the one hand, yes, Kierkegaard wants to see or wants to offer a method by which to bring about a sort of unification of sort of disjointed moments of our own life, of disjointed people, and sort of bring us together in a way that's cohesive, that's harmonious, because each one is acting rightly by his way of describing it. But I think what's most interesting about Kierkegaard to me, and I think what's really exemplified in Fear and Trembling, is the inward dive. And I think, as you said, individualism really plays a huge role in existentialism in general. I mean, as you say, a lot of these existentialists say that your experience, your subjectivity, your perspective on life, all of these things are of great importance to the process that you're and the journey that you're going on. That being said, I think, or rather with that said, there's a lot that Kierkegaard has to offer on what it means to be a knight of faith, as he calls it, what it means to gain faith, and how I think, I would posit this in one of our discussions later on, that that authority that was previously imposed or represented, I should say, by gods or by God singular or by whatever sort of representative of faith people had, that authority never really went away. I don't think it can really go away either. I think that what these existentialists do and do well is offer a way to internalize that authority and to become our own fathers in the archetypal sense of the word, our own authority figures. And many other sociologists and psychologists have pulled on this, people like Jung and Freud. And it's become, I mean, existentialism is unique in how many different fields it touches, really, and how these authors, again, I mean, I'm reading Kierkegaard in my political theory class, and I'm reading, you know, Arendt in philosophy, as I am in poli-sci, as I am in, you know, in even things like economics will draw on readers like, or writers like this. And so it's unique, I think, existentialism in how many fields it touches, and I think it's worthwhile to explore what it means to take that inward dive and where that authority has gone. Because I don't think any existentialist, I shouldn't say that, many of these existentialists don't give us a picture of society that is weak or lawless or disjointed or broken. That authority has to go somewhere. You know, it's sort of a common phrase or trope to throw around that humans like to be told what to do. I think it's true in a lot of cases, but yeah, anyways, I wanted to offer that as maybe a point for us to go into and something I'm excited to talk about.
Sure, absolutely. Mihai is absolutely correct that the beginning of any existential journey begins with an internal look at the individual themselves, right? This is why the Heideggerian method of phenomenology is so crucial to kind of existential investigation with any author, is to realize that, right, the three rules of the study of phenomenology, for which being is for Heidegger, is that we attend to the things themselves, right? So if I am trying to understand who I am in the Sartrean world of forlorn, alone, and in despair, I must look at who I am. I must be willing to look at the characteristics I have, the background I have. I must also, though, be willing to allow my being to present itself to me, right? And part of that ability to, as Heidegger would go on and describe, part of the ability to uncover who a person is through introspection and also the indwelling of worlds, right? And we'll get to that later. But finally, the second and third principles are that all acts are interpretive. There is no objectively correct interpretation of how one should act in that journey of self-discovery. And then the biggest one, and I think it's at the core of all the existentialist authors we'll be looking at, is the world in which you dwell arises out of a fundamental commitment of the heart, right? That the world in which you create, the world in which you explore, is free to be changed by the commitment that you have within your very heart. So what is a fundamental commitment of the heart? I'll use me as an example. So for someone who is desiring to pursue a career in not just research of philosophy, but in teaching philosophy, I've had to go to school, obviously, and continue working through my undergrad. I've taken opportunities to write an honors thesis to help with the graduate program opportunities, right? I will continue to have to work to attain a PhD to come back and teach. I will have to specialize, hone my craft, as it were, right? But that's all good. Why? Because that aligns with the fundamental commitment of my heart. And I think this is important, that Mihai brought up an interesting point, that the authority of God, in a sense, has never gone away. It still shaped our morality in a good number of ways. But the existentialist realizes that we can't depend upon external forces. We have to realize how we must strengthen our internal fortitude. And just as I'm thinking out loud, let me posit this, that Plato was the first existentialist. Why? That's a pretty bold claim. Because in the Republic, when he lays out the idea of the ideal city, there's no hierarchy of powers. There's no designation of this person is the best person. Rather, Socrates desires the reader to imagine a city in which everyone is able to do what they are naturally suited towards. And as they pursue that, they then become the best version of who they are. How do they pursue that? First, by understanding what the desire of their heart is, right? Through reason, right? Thinking about the skills and characteristics that they have, being mentored by others in the community so they can hone their craft. And that transforms everything, right? As much as one can read the city as a collective, because it is a collective, I don't think Socrates, especially when he lays out the tripartite soul and really spends a good amount of time unpacking what that is, would say, don't focus on the individual, focus on the collective. I don't know, just a thought I had. But I think it's interesting because of that question of authority.
Actually, I'm not sure I'm convinced on your claim of Socrates the existentialist, but I just want to put a pin in that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm convinced yet either, but...
It's a bold claim, you recognize that. I think it's an interesting claim. It's one that could definitely get us thinking. If the Socratic principle, the division of labor, as coming from a fundamental commitment of the heart, I mean, Plato does say that we're going to investigate each particular individual, see what they're suited for, and put them where they belong. I'm not sure that squares very well with this idea that we make ourselves, that we have a contribution to make in where we place ourselves in society. For Plato, that seems to be something dictated by a natural order, that you fit into society in a certain way. I also wanted to comment on this relation, or this idea that Socrates is in the investigating the tripartite soul is focusing on the individual. I think that's correct. In the analysis of the tripartite soul, we're looking at a particular human. The tripartite relation of the soul is supposed to resonate with the tripartite relation of the city itself, because the city is supposed to be a metaphor for the individual. So interestingly, I think that actually kind of, if we move on to Heidegger, I think that will interestingly corroborate the claim that he's an existentialist, that there's this really strange relationship between the individual and society. Maybe you can read it in that way. I'm trying to find ways we can read Plato as an existentialist. I think that's a very it's a fun idea.
I would probably just go out there and say no, I don't think that can be the case. I would I would probably just say that within the ideas of philosophy,